5 years and more.
And is no doubt devoted to her mistress.
Well, she's devoted enough, but I won't say to whom.
What on earth do you mean by that?
I can't tell tales out of school, Doctor.
Yes, we quite understand, Mr. Mason. Of course, the situation's clear enough. From Dr. Watson's description of Sir Robert, I can realise that no woman is safe from him. Now, do you think the quarrel between brother and sister may lie there?
Well, it might do, so far as it goes.
So far as it goes?
It doesn't account for Sir Robert going off to the old crypt in the middle of the night. Nor does it help to explain who the man is that he meets there.
Ah. Tell us all about the old crypt.
Well, you'll not get anyone to go there after twilight. It's a godforsaken place and known to be haunted.
The crypt is part of Shoscombe Place, I take it?
No, sir. It's about half a mile from my house. It was the old family burial chapel. All the folders have been laid to rest there for centuries. It's a ruin now and stands all alone in a park. And under the chapel, there's a crypt. Some say it goes back to Saxon times. It's a dark, damp, creepy place, even by daylight.
And no one dares venture there after dark?
There's a story that one of the ancestors of Lady Beatrice's late husband, they call him the Black Folder, walks every night of the dark of the moon.
But this Black Folder holds no terrors for Sir Robert, I take it.
No, Mr. Holmes. It would take more than that to frighten him.
And what of this man he meets there by night?
Well, Stevens the butler, who first suspected something was up just a few nights ago. He came over to the stables the following morning to tell me about it.
It must have been nearly midnight. It was raining hard, as can scarcely have escaped your notice, Mr. Mason. I saw him go out by the side door beneath the North Tower.
Well, that's his own affair, surely. Perhaps he just slipped out to meet some fancy woman.
In the old crypt? Mind you, some people do have very peculiar tastes.
How can you be sure he was going to the old crypt?
Sir Robert keeps a pair of field glasses by the library window. Well, I could follow the course of his lantern along the side of the walled garden and into the park. He must have given some kind of signal, for there was an answering lantern flash from by the ruined chapel.
What the devil can he be doing there?
Well, I can't imagine, Mr. Mason, but I mean to find out. And I want you to help me.
How do you mean?
Come up to the house this evening. We'll have a bite to eat, and I'll keep a wary eye on Sir Robert. If he sets off one of his midnight rambles again, I want you to help me find out what he's up to.
I had no wish to go, Mr. Holmes, but I didn't see how I could well refuse. We hid in the bushes, quaking like two bunny rabbits, and watched Sir Robert meet the man by the ruined chapel.
And did he catch sight of the fellow's face?
Oh, we could see him quite clearly in the moonlight. There was no one I knew. Haggard, yellow face, mean dog, I should say.
And what could they have been doing in the crypt?
As to that, Doctor, Stevens and I took a look round there yesterday morning. Sir Robert had gone up to London for the day.
Hardly a pleasant place, is it, Mr. Mason? I never did care for this kind of thing.
Can't say I want to linger. Oh, nothing seems to have been disturbed.
What about that piece of board in the corner?
Well, nothing much, I fancy.
Oh. Oh, dear, how very nasty.
It's part of a human skull. A few bits of bone.
You informed the police, I suppose?
Well, sir, I thought it would hardly interest them. The bones may well have been 500 years old. They could have just fallen out of one of the ancient coffins. But I'm sure Mr. Palfrimer would never have just stowed them away in a corner like that.
And who is Mr. Palfrimer?
He's one of the vergers at the church, sir. The chapel is his particular responsibility.
Ah, I see. Now, you say Sir Robert was away yesterday.
What?
Has he returned?
We expect him back today.
And when was it he gave away his sister's dog?
It was just a week ago today. The creature was howling outside the old well house, and Sir Robert was in one of his tantrums that morning. He caught it up, and I thought he would have killed it. But he gave it to Sandy Bain, a jockey, and told him to take the dog to old Barnes at the Green Dragon, for he never wished to see it again.
Yes, it's all very intriguing. I'm not clear yet what you want me to do in this matter, Mr. Mason. Can't you make it more more definite?
Perhaps this will make it more definite, Mr. Holmes.
Yes, perhaps it will. Good Lord. A charred fragment of bone. Where did you get it?
There is a central heating furnace in a cellar underneath Lady Beatrice's room. It's been off for some time, but Sir Robert complained of the cold and had it on again. Harvey, he's one of the stable lads, has charge of it. He found the bone when he was raking the cinders this morning. He didn't like the look of it.
No, nor do I. What do you make of it, Watson?
It's the upper condyle of a human femur.
Exactly what I thought. Yeah. When does the lad tend to the furnace?
He makes it up every morning, leaves it.
And anyone could go there during the night.
Well, that's correct.
Can you enter it from outside?
There is one door from the outside. There's another which leads up by a stair to the passage by Lady Beatrice's room.
Yes, these are deep waters, Mr. Mason. Deep and rather murky. Now, you say that Sir Robert was not at home last night.
No, sir.
No. Then whoever was burning bones, it was not he.
That would seem to be the case.
Mm. I think we might take a look into this, Watson.
Mm?
Yes, we might perhaps make the Green Dragon our headquarters.
Ah, and keep an eye on her ladyship's spaniel.
Mm. Is there good fishing in that part of Berkshire?
Well, sir, I've heard there are trout in the mill stream. There's pike in the Hall Lake.
Oh, well, that's good enough. Well, Watson and I are famous fishermen, are we not, Watson?
Ooh, complete angler's home.
Yeah. It might be best if we don't see each other, Mr. Mason. But a note will reach us, and no doubt I could find you if I need to. You should address us in future at the Green Dragon. We should reach there tonight.
Get down. Get down, Jason. I'm sorry, gentlemen. I don't know what's come over him.
You got our telegram, I take it.
Oh, yes, sir. I'll put you in the two rooms at the back, overlooking the garden. Get down. What's the matter with you? I'll get the boy to take your bags up and your fishing tackle. And there's no mistaking what you've come here for, sir.
A famous place for trout, I believe. That's what we've heard.
Well, not exactly here, sir. You'd best try the Verret.
The Verret?
It's about 3 miles out on the north side of the village, sir. You'll be bound to find trout there.
What about the Hall Lake and the chance of a pike?
Oh, whoa, that would never do, sir. You might happen to find yourself in the lake before you were through.
How is that, Mr. Barnes?
Well, it's Sir Robert, sir. He's terribly jealous of touts.
Do he look like touts?
Oh, goodness, no, gentlemen. But Sir Robert is mighty suspicious of any stranger who comes within these parts. The Hall Lake's not a quarter of a mile from his training quarters. If he sees you there, he'll be after you, sure as fate. Ain't taking no chances, Sir Robert ain't.
Who is this Sir Robert?
Sir Robert Norbiton. He has a horse entered for the Derby.
And he fancies his chances, I take it.
Oh, yes, sir. We've all of us put our money on the horse, and Sir Robert's backed him with everything he possesses. I suppose you ain't by any chance on the turf yourself, sir?
Good Lord, no. Just two weary Londoners with the need to put some good Berkshire air into their foggy lungs.
Well, you're in the right place for that. There's a deal of it lying about. But mind what I've told you about Sir Robert. He's a sort that strikes first and speaks afterwards.
You think we're likely to come across him?
Well, not for a day or so, sir. He's gone up to London. But I don't want no trouble if you two go straying about the park and he finds out that you've been putting up here. Just to keep clear of the park, if you please, gentlemen.
You need not concern yourself about that, Mr. Barnes. We certainly shall.
By the way, that was the most beautiful spaniel that made such a fuss when we arrived. Was it bred locally?
What you say was. It was Sir Robert himself as gave it to me. That's why I have to keep it on a lead. It would be off back to the Hall in a jiffy if I gave it its head.
Would it indeed?
Well, if you'll forgive me, gentlemen, I mustn't stay here gossiping. Just let me know if there's anything you want. As I say, the Verret up by Alt's End is the place to take a trout or two.
We'll give it a try, Mr. Barnes. Thanks for your advice.
Well, if there's anything you require, gentlemen, just ring the bell.
Thank you, Mr. Barnes. We're getting some cards in our hand, Watson. It's not an easy one to play, but we may see our way in a day or two. And since Sir Robert's still in London, we might perhaps enter the sacred domain without fear of bodily assault. There are one or two points on which I'd like reassurance.
You have a theory, Holmes?
No, it's too soon for anything so substantial. But of this, I am sure. Something happened a week ago which has cut deep into the heart of the Shoscombe household.
And what do you suppose that could be?
Well, we can only guess at it from its effects. And they seem to be of a curiously mixed character, but that should help us. And it's only the colourless, uneventful case which is hopeless.
I don't quite follow you. What effects do you mean?
Consider the data, Watson. Mm. Sir Robert no longer visits his invalid sister. He gives away her favourite dog to the innkeeper. Her dog, Watson. Does that suggest nothing to you?
Nothing but a brother's spite.
Well, it might be so. Or, well, there is an alternative.
What alternative?
Let's continue our review of the situation from the time that the quarrel began.
We don't know that there was a quarrel.
Well, for the sake of argument, I suppose that there was. The lady keeps to her room, alters her habit, is not seen save when she drives out in her carriage, refuses to stop at the stables to greet her favourite horse, and apparently takes to drink. Yes, that covers the case, does it not?
Save for the business in the crypt.
Well, that's another line of thought. There are two, and I beg you, do not entangle them.
No.
Line A, which concerns Lady Beatrice, has a vaguely sinister flavour, has it not?
I can make nothing of it.
Can you not? Well, then, let us take up line B, which concerns Sir Robert. Now, he's determined to win the Derby. He's in the hands of the moneylenders and may at any moment be sold up and his racing stables seized by his creditors. He's a daring and desperate man. He derives all his income from his sister. His sister's maid is his willing tool. Huh? So far, we seem to be on fairly secure ground, do we not?
But the crypt.
Ah, yes, the crypt. Let us suppose it's merely a scandalous supposition, a hypothesis put forward for argument's sake, that Sir Robert has done away with his sister.
But, my dear Holmes, that is out of the question.
Very possibly, Watson.
Sir Robert is a man of honourable stock.
Yes, but you do occasionally find a carrion crow among the eagles. Let's for a moment argue upon this supposition. He couldn't fly the country until he'd realised his fortune, and that fortune could only be realised by winning the Derby with Shoscombe Prince. Therefore, he still has to stand his ground.
But how does he do that?
Well, to begin with, he'd have to dispose of the body of his victim, and he'd also have to find a substitute who would impersonate her. And with a maid as his confidant, that would not be impossible. His sister's body might be conveyed to the crypt, which is a place of evil reputation and seldom visited, and it might be secretly destroyed at night in the furnace, leaving behind it such evidence as we've already seen. Yeah? What do you say to that, Watson?
Well, it is all possible, I suppose, if you grant the original monstrous supposition.
Yeah. I think that there's a small experiment we may try tomorrow. Might throw some light on the matter. First of all, we need some good reason why we cannot go fishing, something that we've forgotten that could rule out the whole day.
We could have forgotten our spoon bait, perhaps.
A spoon bait, capital. And I think that I'll propose to Mr. Josiah Barnes that we take his highly bred black spaniel for a walk in the direction of Shoscombe Old Park.
I can't say I care very much for the heraldic griffins on the gate.
Too ostentatious by half.
If we may trust the boot boy at the inn, it's by this gate that Lady Beatrice takes her midday drive in her open barouche.
It's nearly 12 now.
The carriage will have to slow down while the gates are opened. When it comes through and before it gathers speed again, I want you, Watson, to stop the coachman with some question or other.
I think that might be arranged. That must be them now. What will you be doing?
Never mind about me. I'll stand behind this holly bush with the dog and see what I can see.
Very well.
Here they are. Lady Beatrice, smothered in shawls, but veil over her face, and a girl who looks no better than she should be by her side, the maid, I presume. The man's coming out to open the gates. Off you go, Watson.
Good day, your ladyship.
I say, coachman, I say, can you tell me if Sir Robert is at Shoscombe Old Place?
Gently now, boy, gently. Now then, go. Go to your mistress.
Get the horse away! Get it away! Get it off me! Drive on, man! Drive on!
Come here, boy! Come here! Come here!
There. Good boy. You thought it was your mistress, didn't you? Turned out to be a stranger, didn't it?
Well then, are you satisfied?
Dogs don't make mistakes.
But it was a man's voice.
Exactly, Watson. We've added one card to our hand, but it needs careful playing all the same.
So, how should we proceed?
Well, first, we shall take this highly perceptive creature back to the Green Dragon, and then we shall miraculously discover that we've brought our bait after all.
But why should we want to do that?
Because I've arranged to meet our good friend Mr. Mason by the millstream.
No. If you throw your line like that, you'll put the fear of God into every fish for half a mile.
Do I have to remind you that we're not here to fish?
Since we are here, we may as well try to keep up a decent appearance. Cast your line lightly, Holmes, lightly.
Oh, very well.
Lightly, I said.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening, Mr. Mason.
I got your note, Mr. Holmes. I came as quickly as I could.
Sir Robert returned?
Not yet, but I've received word that he's expected tonight.
Yeah, and there's no time to be lost. Let's get him to the crypt without delay. Yeah, will you take us there?
Oh, I can't afford to do that, Mr. Holmes. The moment he returns home, he'll want to see me to get the latest news about Shoscombe Prince.
It'll take too long for us to root about the place on our own. Is there someone who knows the crypt well?
Well, there's Mr. Palfreyman, the verger.
But can he be trusted not to tell Sir Robert?
If you care to make it worth his while, Doctor, his duties here have given him a taste for things spiritual.
Whiskey?
gin, I believe. But what am I to say your purpose is? Do I tell him who you are?
Inform him that Mr. Podmore and Dr. Gurney from the Society for Psychical Research have come to investigate the legend of the Black Folder and wish to examine his grave. That should give us sufficient cover, I think.
Have a care, gentlemen. The stair is steep, and the treads are worn away.
Place smells vilely.
The dead don't smell sweet. There are 9 centuries of them in this place. But you gentlemen must be accustomed to this kind of thing.
Every place seems to have its own aura. I feel that we're in the presence of some mysterious evil.
Coffins of lead, coffins of stone, coffins of wood, all piled up on top of one another, as if there was so much lumber.
Who can tell what strange causes and effects there may be beyond the veil? Kindly be our guide to this place, Mr. Porfirman. Who is buried here?
Oh, I only wish I could tell you, Mr. Podmore. I know the recent ones, of course. Those from the 16th century onwards. They're all the wooden coffins stacked over there. The last Lord Calder, Lady Beatrice's husband, is the one on top.
And the coffins of stone?
Oh, some of them are said to go back before the Conquest. But they contain nothing more than dust. Dust and a few scraps of bone.
Quite, quite. And the lead coffins here?
Oh, they're mostly from medieval times.
And what can you tell me about the coffin there? The one that stands beside the stair?
Oh, my God. May the Lord save us.
What's the matter, man?
Well, it's never stood there before. Well, I stake my life on it. But it kind of moved itself. What is happening in this place?
That is precisely what Dr. Gurney and I are here to investigate. Now, Mr. Polverman, it would be as well, I think, if you were to leave us.
Oh, if that's what you wish, sir.
The test that we have to carry out will only be hampered by the presence of anyone not accustomed to our methods.
But you will close the vault when you leave?
Rest assured, Mr. Polverman.
Then I'll leave you to it, gentlemen.
Thank you for all your help, Mr. Polverman.
A pleasure, gentlemen. A pleasure.
Just make certain that he's really going away, Watson. There's a good fellow.
Yes. He's walking off quite briskly. Probably wants to get back to the bottle of gin we gave him.
Now then, it's time to lay the ghosts of Shoscombe Chapel. Let's take a closer look at the coffin by the stairs.
Seemed to give Mr. Palfreyman quite a fright.
As it should have done. Look closely, Watson, at the edges of the coffin lid. Someone's cut along the whole line of it. It's only secured by these 2 clamps. That should be an easy matter to open it up. You have the jimmy?
In my pocket. Here.
Yes, now then. Yes, excellent.
Now, help me up with the lid.
Good Lord.
Who the devil are you? What do you think you're doing? What the hell are you doing on my property, do you hear me? Who are you?
Sir Robert Norbiton, I believe. I have a question to ask you. Who is this within the coffin? What is this body doing here?
How came you to know of this? What business is it of yours?
My name is Sherlock Holmes. Possibly it's familiar to you. In any case, my business is that of every other good citizen to uphold the law. It seems to me that you have much to answer for.
Before God, Mr. Holmes, I swear to you that it is not as it seems. Appearances are against me, I admit. But I could act no otherwise.
I should be happy to think so. But I fear your explanations must be for the police.
Well, if it must be, it must be. Come up to the house with me and you can judge for yourself how the matter stands.
So, what do you suppose Sir Robert means to do now?
To present us for the justification of his strange conduct, Watson. What else?
Do you believe that he murdered his sister? That was Lady Beatrice in the coffin, I take it.
Oh, most certainly. As for his guilt, I prefer to reserve my judgment till I've heard what he has to say. But mark my words, Sir Robert is a desperate man. He's prepared to take any course that will save him. And I suspect that he would not stop short of murder.
I refuse to be dragged into this. It has nothing to do with me.
If you know what's good for you, you'll do as Sir Robert says.
For God's sake, keep quiet, both of you, until I've had my say.
Who are these people, Sir Robert? And what have they to do with the case?
They are Mr. and Mrs. Norlett. Mrs. Norlett, under her maiden name of Evans, has for some years been my sister's confidential maid.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Evening.
I've decided that my best, indeed my only course, is to explain the true position to you, Mr. Holmes. And these are the only two people on earth who can substantiate what I say.
I had nothing to do with it. It wasn't my idea.
Will you hold your tongue?
I will take all the responsibility upon myself, Norlett. And you have nothing to fear.
You've left it a bit late to tell me that.
You've gone pretty deeply into my affairs, Mr. Holmes, or I should have not found you where I did. Now, how the devil you came to be there, I cannot imagine.
You obviously know very little of my colleague's reputation, Sir Robert.
I know that you're running a dark horse for the Derby, Sir Robert, and that you've staked everything upon it.
I've staked my life upon it, Mr. Holmes. If I win, all is easy.
And if you lose?
I dare not think of it. I cannot think of it.
We understand all that very well, Sir Robert.
I am dependent upon my sister Lady Beatrice for everything. For the estate, for the horses, for the very clothes on my back. But you must understand that her interest in the estate and in the Falder fortune is for her lifetime only.
For her own lifetime, yes.
It has always been my greatest fear that if my sister were to die, my creditors would be onto the estate like a flock of vultures. Everything would be seized on, my stables, my horses, everything. Well, Mr. Holmes, my sister did die just a week ago.
And you told no one?
What could I do? I was faced with absolute ruin. If I could only stave things off for 3 weeks, everything would be well. My sister's maid's husband, this man here, is an actor.
I told you, I won't be dragged into this.
It came into our heads.
I had nothing whatever to do with it. It wasn't my idea.
It came into my head that he could, for that short period, impersonate my sister. It was but a case of appearing daily in the carriage.
No one else ever saw her, you see, except for me.
What was the cause of your sister's death, Sir Robert?
She died of dropsy, Dr. Watson. She'd been suffering from it for years.
That'll be a matter for the coroner to decide. So what did you do?
The body could not remain here at Shoscombe. On the first night, Norlett and I carried it into the old well house, which is now never used.
He forced me into it. I had no wish to be party to such a thing.
Unfortunately, her pet spaniel refused to leave her side and wailed so piteously that it was essential to get rid of it as quickly as possible.
And so you gave it to the landlord of the Green Dragon.
There seems to be precious little that you two haven't discovered. After I disposed of the dog, we carried the body by night to the old Falder crypt. There was no indignity or irreverence. I do not feel that I have wronged the dead.
Your conduct seems to me to be inexcusable, Sir Robert.
It's easy to preach, Mr. Holmes.
You shovel your poor sister away in a stinking vault without ceremony.
It is still consecrated ground, Doctor, and it seemed no dishonour to give her a temporary resting place in the coffin of one of her husband's ancestors.
May I say something?
Yes, Mrs. Norlett.
I am certain that Lady Beatrice would have borne Sir Robert no ill will for what he has done. She would not have wished to see shame and ruin fall upon him. I know that she would have understood.
Thank you, Carrie.
Continue your story, Sir Robert.
We opened up one of the coffins and removed the contents.
The remains of Ralph de Falder, I believe.
It did not seem to me to matter much who it was. We placed my sister in the coffin, as you discovered. As to the old relics which we had taken out, Norlett and I removed them, and he burned them in the furnace beneath my sister's room.
I was only doing what he told me to, Mr. Holmes.
And he promised to pay you handsomely, I have no doubt. But there is one flaw in your narrative, Sir Robert. Your bets on the race, and therefore your hopes for the future, would have held good even if your creditors had seized the estate.
No, Mr. Holmes. The horse itself would be part of the estate. Shoscombe Prince would go along with everything else. What do my creditors care for my bets? As likely as not, they would not run the horse at all. My chief creditor is, unhappily, my most bitter enemy. A rascally fellow, Sam Brewer.
The man you took a horsewhip to on Newmarket Heath.
The very same, Doctor. Do you suppose that he would try to save me?
Well, Sir Robert, this matter must, of course, be referred to the police. It was my duty to bring the facts to light. And there I must leave it.
But surely, Mr. Holmes, you must understand...
Ask the morality or decency of your own conduct. It's not for me to express an opinion.
But if news of this should get about before the Derby, I shall be ruined.
Surely, Mr. Holmes, you must see that the least hint of a scandal of this kind would be certain to make Sir Robert's creditors foreclose on him. Nothing can harm Lady Beatrice now. And the poor wretch who was shoveled out of his grave has been dead for 500 years. Can you not hold your hand until after the race?
The law must take its course, Mrs. Norland. But it would give me no satisfaction to see Sir Robert ruined. My report on these strange proceedings will fall on the commissioner's desk the day after the derby. But have a care, Sir Robert. I am not unknown to the police. The least word from me may influence the outcome for good or ill.
I've learnt my lesson, Mr. Holmes, and I am very grateful. You have been most understanding.
Then, as it's nearly midnight, I think, Watson, that we'll make our way back to our humble lodging. The outcome rests in the hands of fortune, Sir Robert.
Fast brick a lavender, sir.
No, no, thank you.
It'll bring you good luck, sir. Never fails.
No, no.
You'll regret it if you don't. Who knows what nasty fate might catch up with you. Go on, sir. Only a penny.
Oh, very well. Here.
Let me pin it to your coat. May fortune smile upon you, sir.
Dr. Watson!
Mr. Mason!
Come to see the case through to the end, eh?
Nothing of the kind. I'll have you know, Mr. Mason, that I've attended every derby for the last 10 years.
Is Mr. Holmes here?
No, it seems he had to attend a highly confidential meeting with the Turkish ambassador. What are you doing out here? Shouldn't you be with Soskin Prince?
Oh, there's no need for me to worry, Doctor. Not with Sir Robert around. He won't let him out of his sight for 10 seconds. He's put everything he possesses on that horse, and a good deal that he doesn't.
He must be a very anxious man.
Well, if he is, he isn't letting it show. He's cool as a cucumber, he is. Ever since you and Mr. Holmes had your little encounter with him in the crypt, he's been a changed man. Courteous, considerate.
He has good reason to be. He was lucky to be let off the hook. Mind you, if that young woman hadn't put in a word for him...
Yeah, well, what woman?
Mrs. Norlett.
Mrs. Norlett? Oh, so that's the game now, is it?
I don't follow you.
Well, I suppose he thinks that by passing her off as that fellow's wife, no one will raise an eyebrow at her staying on at Shoscombe Old Place. She's still playing Carrie Evans. And he's Evans, too, her brother. He's been sponging off her for years.
Well, a very edifying specimen of humanity.
Well, I'd better be getting back to Shoscombe, Prince. Not long to go now.
And Sir Robert's creditors, are they holding off?
Until the race is over. After all, it's in their interest. If the prince wins, they'll get their money back. So they'll be cheering him on with the rest of us.
Good luck to you all, Mr. Mason.
Thank you, Doctor.
Hey, you look like a man who knows what's what.
I beg your pardon?
What a tip.
A tip?
It's a sure thing.
Look, just run along, will you?
Oh, it's a dead shirt. Come on, come on. It costs you a guinea.
Kindly leave me alone.
You can't lose. You can stay your warm pension on him.
Good Lord. Is that you, Holmes? I thought you were with the Turkish ambassador.
I thought that my time might be better employed down here. I've been keeping a wary eye on Sir Robert, making sure that he plays the game.
How do you mean?
Well, 100 ways in which a man can influence the course of a race if he puts his mind to it. If by any chance Sir Robert does win this race, I want to be certain that he does so fairly and squarely. Hence, my disguise.
It certainly took me in. And what have you found out?
Oh, that Sir Robert is the soul of honour. To test him, I even ventured to put a little temptation in his way myself and suggested a few subtle ways by which the performance of some of his keenest rivals might be impaired.
And how did he react?
I was lucky to escape the fate he once handed out of Sam Brewer, the Norbiton horse whip.
The race is about to begin.
I must get rid of my little disguise. I'll see you after the race in the winner's enclosure.
Come on! Come on! Shoscombe Prince! Well, Sir Robert, I could have wished for no other outcome. You won as you deserve to win.
I deserve nothing, Mr. Holmes. I was lucky to be able to run the horse at all.
And now at last, you can be free of your creditors.
With £80,000 in my pocket, I shall be able to do better than that. And the first thing I shall do is to erect a suitable memorial to my dear sister.
You'll have to face an inquest before that, Sir Robert. But I trust I'll be able to persuade the police and the coroner to take a lenient view of the matter.
I cannot express my gratitude, Mr. Holmes.
Well, the worst you can expect will probably be a mild censure for delaying to register your sister's decease.
And that's considerably better than I deserve. Goodbye, Mr. Holmes. Goodbye, Doctor.
Goodbye, Sir Robert. And congratulations. It was a fine race.
Thank you, Doctor.
Norbert. And now, Watson, I think we can take leave of these joyful scenes and return to the modest tranquility of 221B Baker Street.
Yes, of course. There is one little thing to be cleared up before we leave.
What is that?
I must collect my winnings.
In Shoscombe Old Place, Sherlock Holmes was played by Clive Medicine and Dr. Watson by Michael Williams, with Nicholas Leprevo as John Mason and Donald Pickering as Sir Robert Norbottom. Paul Freeman was played by Desmond Llewellyn, Josiah Barnes by Jonathan Adams, Stevens by George Parsons, Carrie by Susanna Corbett, Norlett by Jonathan Keeble, and the Gypsy by Becky Hindley. Other parts were played by members of the cast. The violinist was Leonard Friedman. Shoscombe Old Place was dramatised for radio by Michael Bakewell and directed by Enid Williams.
Come in, sir, I beg you. May I take your case?
I shall hold on to it for the moment, if I may, Mr. Holder.
Do us great honour. It's just that I'm not sure what...
Simply, Mr. Holder, a matter of £50,000 for 4 days. A trifling sum many of my friends would oblige me with, but personal obligation in my case.
Indeed, and... if my own purse at the moment were able to stand the strain. However, that means the firm, which means safeguarding my partner.
Of course. Now, you may take the case, Mr. Holder, and open it if you'd be so kind.
My dear sir.
Sufficient safeguard, Mr. Holder? Good. I see it is.
The Beryl Coronet by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Dramatised for radio by Vincent McInerney. With Clive Medicine as Sherlock Holmes and Michael Williams as Dr. John Watson. And featuring Anthony Newlands as Alexander Holder and Angus Wright as his son Arthur. The Beryl Coronet.
One crisp, sunny February morning, I was standing in our bow window at 221B Baker Street, looking down on yesterday's snow, when my attention was taken by the eccentric conduct of a gentleman coming our way from the direction of the Metropolitan Station. About 50, tall, portly, and imposing, with a massive, strongly marked face and commanding figure. He was running hard, with occasional little springs into the air, such as a weary man gives who is unaccustomed to set any tax upon his legs. The whole thing was so out of the way, I felt obliged to bring it to the attention of my companion, sitting behind me in his armchair.
Holmes, Here is a madman coming along. Oh, poor fellow. That his relatives should allow him to come out alone.
That, Watson, depends on where he is coming to.
Why, he's looking up at the number of the houses near us.
I rather believe because he is looking for this one. I think I recognise the symptoms.
And even as Holmes spoke, the man, puffing and blowing, rushed at our door and pulled the bell until the whole house resounded with the clanging. And a few minutes later, entered our room. Holmes immediately went to him, pushed him into an easy chair, and sitting beside him began to chat in those easy, soothing tones which he knew so well how to employ.
You have come to tell me your story, have you not? But are fatigued with your haze. Now, pray wait until you've recovered, and I will only be too happy to look at any little problem which you may submit to me. Hmm? A glass of water, perhaps.
Yes, a glass of water would help.
Watson, would you, old fellow?
Of course.
Here you are, sir. Small sips, I think, for the moment.
Watson, I should add, sir, is a medical man, late of the Indian Army, and my friend and confidant.
Yes, the police told me I would find him here with you, Mr. Holmes, and that he was completely trustworthy.
Oh, indeed.
Now, Mr. Holmes, no doubt you think me mad.
I see you've had some great trouble.
God knows, public disgrace and private affliction. Yet up to now, never a stain on my character. And that is not all. The very noblest in the land may suffer, too. Unless some way is found out of this horrible affair.
Then pray, sir, let me have a clear account of both who you are and what has befallen you.
My name is Alexander Holder of Holder and Stevenson, Threadneedle Street. Name may be familiar to you.
The second largest banking concern in the whole of London, I believe.
As you are right, Dr. Watson. Where it will stand tomorrow. However, yesterday morning, then, I was seated in my office when a card was brought into me by one of the clerks. I started when I saw the name, one which I feel I cannot divulge even here, and ordered its bearer to be asked to enter immediately. He did so, carrying a black Morocco case, and with the air of a man who wishes to hurry quickly through a disagreeable task, to wit, the securing of a loan of £50,000 for 4 days. He pointed out that he could borrow such a trifling sum 10 times over from his friends, but that he felt it was unwise to place himself under personal obligation. I, for my part, responded that I would be more than happy to advance it from my own purse, but that, unfortunately, it just would not bear the strain. My noble visitor accepted the implication that the money would therefore have to come from the firm against collateral, and he put forward the Morocco case. Inside was the beryl coronet.
Why, that means...
It is one of the most precious possessions of the Empire.
Precisely. A circlet of chased gold set with 39 enormous beryls, which, as you know, are related to emeralds. The lowest estimate of its worth would be twice the sum asked.
You had no qualms about an article of such inestimable public interest being given into your safekeeping?
Not initially. I immediately locked the coronet in my private safe until close of business. Then, about to go home, I recalled that banker's safes have been forced before now. So I ordered a cab, had myself escorted into it, and drove the 8 or so miles to Streatham. The Morocco case containing the coronet on my knee and my heart in my mouth every inch of the way.
You travelled via London Bridge?
Fearing it would collapse under me at any moment.
And when you arrived home?
Immediately locked the case into an old bureau that stands in my dressing room.
And then?
Mr. Holmes, Dr. Watson, I wonder if I might talk for a short while about my household. My groom and page sleep out of the house and can be set aside altogether. I have 3 tried and trusted older maidservants and 1 younger girl, Lucy Parr, who's been with me only a few months but who came with an excellent character and has given complete satisfaction. She is, however, very pretty, and has admirers who sometimes hang about the place.
There is one at the moment?
A local tradesman, I believe, the greengrocer, one Frank Prosper.
Prosper, I see. Please continue.
Which brings me to my own immediate family. I am a widower, as you may have guessed, with an only son, Arthur.
Tell us about him, Mr. Hope.
He has been a disappointment to me. A grievous disappointment. Though I lay the blame at my own door. You see, when my wife died, he became everything to me. I could not bear to see the smile fade from his small, shining face for even a moment. So he asked, and I gave. With predictable but distressing results. Why?
Mr. Holder, we are not far now, I think. Your clarity is excellent. Narrative arresting, your audience eager. Pray, do continue.
Yes, of course. Arthur. It was naturally my intention he should succeed me in my business. But he was not of a business turn. There were large sums of money he would have been required to handle had he come into the firm. If I make myself clear. But he is a good lad at heart and so popular, which, unfortunately, when he was younger, led him to be invited to join an aristocratic gaming club. There, purses were long, habits expensive, play deep, and his skill at cards insufficient. At which point he would turn to me for help.
Which you afforded him.
How could I refuse? At least until the cause of it all is Sir George Burnwell. Uh-huh. Arthur has never been the same since he met him. Yet when the man comes to the house, I can hardly resist him myself. Mary, too, fears his. I'm sure, having seen the way she studies him.
Mary?
My adoptive niece. My dead brother's child. A sunbeam, Mr. Holmes. Ah, if only she and Arthur. Who knows? Had she accepted Arthur's suit, things may not have transpired as they did. There are so many possible permutations, Mr. Holmes, so many...
Pray, Mr. Holder, what were these things?
Of course. That evening, then, I locked the coronet in my bureau, as I've told you, and I went down to dinner. Afterwards, taking coffee in the drawing room, I told Arthur and Mary my experience and of the precious treasure we had under our roof, suppressing only the name of our client. Lucy Parr, who had brought the coffee, had, I'm sure, left the room, but I cannot swear that the door was closed. Mary and Arthur were much interested and wanted to see the coronet, but I decided not to disturb it. Then Arthur asked me where I had put it. I told him in the bureau, in my dressing room, at which he laughed and intimated that the bureau could be opened with almost any key in the house. This wild way of talking unsettled me, and I decided to retire. Arthur, however, insisted in accompanying me upstairs and followed me into my bedroom. Final effort, I assume, to persuade me to show him the coronet. Instead, however, it was just one more request for help. And, as I say, I was very tired. £200 and the third time this month! Sir George Burnwell again, I suppose.
Among others... Dad.
No, Arthur, not Dad. Not this time. Heaven knows I have been generous, thinking if I indulged you for a while, you would eventually come to your senses and give up your high play out of duty and shame. But that is obviously not to be.
Yes, you've been very kind, more than kind. And believe me, I am as sick of appealing to you as you are of hearing me. But I must have this money. Otherwise, I can never show my face in the club again. I assure you, it has come to that.
Which is the best reason of all not to give it to you.
Well, I agree. But it would mean I leave a dishonored man, and this you surely cannot want.
Dad, just this once. Then I give you my word I will quit the place of my own accord and will study finance with a view to joining the firm. You have my solemn word as a gentleman. Will you, Dad? Just once more.
And how would your friend Sir George feel about you dropping him and his set?
I think Sir George has almost completed the business that brings him to this house, and I have no more money to lose to him. No, I do not think my resigning from the club will greatly distress Sir George.
Well, Arthur, you are persuasive, but it is a melody that I have heard too many times. I'm sorry, my boy, but you get no more money from me to settle your debts. Not a farthing. Now, good night.
Sir.
At which, gentleman, he made me a bow and quietly left.
It must have been very hard for you.
Very hard. For I would give up my life for him if needs be. But I could not bear to go on financing the eventual death in life to which his profligate ways were leading him.
What do you think he meant in his reference to Sir George Burnwell?
I have no idea, Mr. Holmes, and I was too distressed to consider it at that time. I suppose it was something to the effect that, having bled my son dry, Sir George would now be off looking to find another gull.
And what happened then?
Something prompted me to check the house was secure for the night. Duty I usually leave to Mary, but what with...
Of course.
So I came out of my room and started down the stairs. As I did so, I saw Mary herself at the side window of the hall, which she closed and fastened as I approached, and then came to meet me. Looking, I felt quite disturbed.
Uncle, I did not expect to see you.
I thought tonight, my child, I would look around myself. What with the coronet being on the premises?
Yes, of course.
Did I see you at the hall window there, my dear? Nothing untoward happening outside, I hope.
Why, I did hear a noise. Tell me, Uncle, did you give Lucy leave to go out tonight?
Certainly not.
She came in just now by the back door. She has no doubt only been to the side gate to see someone. But, as you say, what with...
But you were quite right. It's far too late for such goings on. I'll speak to her in the morning. You're sure everything is fastened?
Quite sure. But I will recheck if you wish.
No. Your word is good enough, as it always is. So, good night, my child. Good night.
Good night, Uncle.
I am endeavouring to tell you everything, Mr. Holmes, that may have any bearing on the case, but I beg you, question me on any point I do not make clear.
On the contrary, your statement is singularly lucid.
Good. For now, I come to a part of my story in which I should wish it to be particularly so. I'm not a very heavy sleeper, and what with the anxiety in my mind, the fact is that about 2 in the morning I was awakened by some sound in the house, which left an impression that a window had been closed somewhere. Suddenly, to my horror, I heard distinctly the soft padding of feet in my dressing room. I threw the covers back and quietly opened the connecting door. The gas was half up, the bureau was open. My son, Arthur, dressed only in shirt and trousers, was standing holding the coronet in both hands. He appeared to be attempting simultaneously to both wrench and bend it. I cried out and he dropped it. I snatched it up. One of its decorative protruding leaves containing 3 beryls was missing. I could contain myself no longer. You blackguard! You have destroyed it! Dishonored me! You villain! Where are the jewels? Where are the jewels you have stolen?
Stolen?
Yes, you thief! Where are they?
There are none missing. There cannot
be. There are 3 missing! Must I call you a liar as well as a thief? Did I not see you trying to tear off yet another piece?
You have called me names enough, and I will stand it no longer. I will leave the house in the morning and make my own way in the world.
You shall leave in the hands of the police. I shall have this matter probed to its conclusion.
Then call them, Father, and let them find what they can. They shall learn nothing from me.
The whole establishment was astir by now, and Mary rushed in, followed by 2 of the older housemaids. When Mary saw the coronet and Arthur, she gave a scream and fell to the ground. I sent 1 of the housemaids for the police, instructing the other to tend my niece. Arthur stood silent and white-faced near the wall until the arrival of the inspector and constable, and then asked if I intended to charge him with theft. I replied that as the ruined coronet was national property, the law must be evoked. At that point, he told me that it would be to both our advantages if he were to be allowed to leave the house for 5 minutes. I asked him once more to tell me what he had done with the missing stones, and that if he did so, all would be forgiven and forgotten. His reply was that I should keep my forgiveness for those who ask for it. Shortly after, I gave him into custody. This morning, he was removed to a cell, and I have now hurried round to you. The police confess they can make nothing of it. There is already a reward of £1,000. Mr. Holmes, I have lost my honour, my gems, and my son in one night. What am I to do?
Watson, my cherry wood pipe from behind you, if you will, old fellow. Thank you. Mr. Holder, do you receive much company?
None, save my partner and his family. Occasionally we would meet a friend of Arthur's who would call.
Sir George Burnwell, for instance.
Of course, you are right, Doctor. Sir George has spent a great deal of time with the house lately, so much so that I was tending to overlook him completely.
And do you, in turn, go about much in society?
No, I'm afraid Mary and I are very much homebirds, although she has been going up to town a little more recently.
How old is Mary, Mr. Holder?
About 24, I believe.
And had little to do with the world and its ways. This matter seems to have shocked her a great deal.
Terribly. And she will not, for some reason, hear of Arthur being guilty.
You yourself have no doubts.
But how can I? I saw him holding the coronet.
But surely the coronet was twisted due to having the piece snapped off. What if Arthur was simply trying to straighten it?
If his purpose were innocent, why did he not say so?
And if guilty, why not invent a lie? There's something not quite right about his silence. You agree, Watson?
Absolutely. Could he have been protecting someone, Mr. Holder?
But who? I will vouch for my staff completely, except Lucy, whom Arthur has hardly spoken to in the short time she's been with us.
What did the police think of the noise that woke you from your sleep?
It was Arthur closing the dressing room door.
Oh, well, if so, he would be the first felon who ever knowingly slammed a door to awake a household. Yes, and the disappearance of the gems?
They're still sounding the planking and probing the furniture in the hopes of finding them.
And outside?
At 2, Doctor. Searching every inch of the garden.
Mr. Holder, is it not obvious that this matter strikes very much deeper than you or the police were at first inclined to think? Considered as what's involved by the theory to which you and the police hold, that is, that your son left his bed, went at great risk to your dressing room, opened your bureau, took out the coronet, snapped off a small portion containing 3 jewels, then went to some other place to conceal this portion with such skill that nobody can find it, and finally returned with the other 36 barrels to a room where he stood the greatest danger of being, and indeed was, discovered. Is, Mr. Holder, such an explanation tenable?
But what other is there?
That it is our task to find out. So now, we will set off for Streatham, where we will perhaps devote an hour to glancing a little more closely into details.
My friend insisted on me accompanying them in their expedition, which I was eager enough to do, for my curiosity and sympathy were deeply stirred by the story to which we had listened. And so, after a short railway journey, and an even shorter walk, we stood in front of Fairbank, the residence of the great financier. It was a square, good-sized dwelling, a little from the road, and with a double carriage sweep stretching down to 2 large iron gates. On the right side of the house was a small wooden gate which opened to a path to the tradesman's entrance, while on the left ran a lane to the stables, which was a public, though little used, thoroughfare. We entered the gates and walked slowly towards the front of the house. Then, shortly before we reached it, Holmes left us, saying he intended to walk completely round the building. Holder and I waited for a time for him, but feeling the cold, Holder suggested we go inside. We therefore entered the house, made our way across the mosaic flooring, and into the dining room where we took a chair in silence by the fire. Suddenly the door opened, and a young lady came in, rather above middle height and with dark hair and eyes, which the extreme pallor of her skin rendered even darker. In her early 20s, I thought, and distraught to a high degree, her eyes red and swollen with crying. This I assumed to be Holder's niece, Mary. Disregarding my presence entirely, she went straight to her uncle and passed her hand over his brow with what seemed to be genuine affection.
Uncle, is Arthur released yet? Have you given orders he should be liberated?
No, no, Mary. This matter must be fully probed.
But I am so sure he is innocent. You know what women's instincts are.
Then why is he so silent?
I don't know. Perhaps he is angry that you should suspect him at all.
But how could I not suspect him? Caught red-handed with the damaged coronet in the dead of night.
Perhaps he had just picked it up to look at it. Perhaps someone else had dropped it. Oh, do take my word for it. Let the matter go and say no more.
I shall never let the matter go. Not until the gems are found. Never. I am sorry, my dear, but your affection towards Arthur blinds you to the possible awful consequences to me. In fact, I have brought a gentleman down from London to inquire into it.
This gentleman here?
No, this is his colleague, Dr. Watson.
Your servant, Miss Holder.
The gentleman in question is Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
Sherlock Holmes?
Ah, Miss Mary Holder. I do have the honour of addressing Miss Mary Holder, do I not? Miss Holder, given the small amount of time we have and the magnitude of the task, I wonder if I might immediately ask a question or two in order to establish the possible guilt or innocence of parties concerned in this matter.
All you want, Mr. Holmes, if it will succeed in proving what I feel to be true, that my cousin Arthur is blameless.
An opinion you will be pleased to hear I share. Now to begin. You heard nothing yourself last night during the period the theft took place.
Not until my uncle began to shout loudly at Arthur. Then I came down.
You lock up of an evening, I believe, Miss Holder, so last night it was you who secured all the windows and doors.
Yes.
Yes, and they were all fastened this morning.
Yes.
However, your uncle told myself and my associate, Dr. Watson, that he saw you late last night at the window that leads to the stable lane.
I had been to lock the kitchen door when I saw Lucy, the maid, slip in through it. I went to the side window to see, if possible, where she had been. Looking out, I saw a man at the far end of the path in the gloom.
You recognized him?
Frank Prosper, the greengrocer.
Still, it is nothing for a young girl to wish to see her young man, is it?
Except, I remember Lucy round and about the drawing room when Uncle was telling us of the coronet.
I see. You infer she may have gone out to tell her sweetheart about the jewels and so plan a robbery with him?
These vague theories, Mr. Holmes, when I have told you I saw Arthur himself with the coronet in his hand.
You have not answered my question, Miss Holder. Are you inferring Lucy and her sweetheart are responsible for the theft?
I am telling you what I saw, Mr. Holmes.
I found it difficult to visualize, Miss Holder, especially as Prosper has a wooden leg, does he not?
Why, Mr. Holmes, however could you know that?
He has his methods, Miss Holder, to reach the truth, however deeply it may have been buried.
And now we shall go upstairs.
Our first stop was the hall, where Holmes halted to walk swiftly round all the lower windows, opening the one leading to the stable lane and closely examining its sill with his lens, after which we proceeded to the dressing room from which the coronet had been taken. This was a plainly furnished little chamber with a grey carpet, large bureau, and a dressing table with a long mirror. Holmes immediately went to the bureau and stared hard at it for a time.
Mr. Holder, which key was used to open the lock?
The key to the lumber room, one of those my son mentioned. It's over there on the dressing table.
Yeah. It's almost noiseless. No wonder it did not wake you. And this, I take it, is the case containing the coronet. We must have a look at it. May I?
Good heavens.
Now, Mr. Holder, here is the corner which corresponds to that which has been so unfortunately lost. Might I beg that you would break it off?
Mr. Holmes, I should not dream of trying.
Well, then I will try.
Oh, no.
Yes, no, even though I'm exceptionally strong in the fingers. And what do you think would happen if I did manage to snap it, Watson?
Crack like a pistol shot, I should think.
Exactly, which would certainly carry a few yards to where you slept in the next room, Mr. Holder. So why did your uncle not hear this noise, Miss Holder?
I am perplexed.
Indeed. Your son had no shoes or slippers on when you saw him?
No, nothing but his trousers.